Hey everyone, thanks for joining me again for another podcast. Today I have sociologist Rod Graham from Old Dominion University with us. And we're going to talk about how academics engage with the public during an age of rapid technological change. So YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, all of these different platforms, how academics can engage in public sociology or public criminology. We're also talking about the role of class and higher education and making your way through higher education and what role class can play. And in the end, we talk about forming a new imagined community. So post-uprising, post-George Floyd homicide and the uprisings that followed, as Americans, how can we create a new shared ethos so that we can move forward as an imagined community in the 21st century? So it's a really interesting conversation. I had a great time. I hope you enjoy it. If you find these useful, please hit the subscribe button down below or follow me, depending on your platform. And again, sit back and enjoy. And I really, really appreciate your time. Hey, thanks for taking the time to join me. I really appreciate it. So before we just get started, I like to just, everybody who comes on, just give you a chance to introduce yourself a little bit. And I introduced you, like who you are and what you do for work basically, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe where you grew up?
Sure. So I'm from a small town in South Carolina, Lake City, South Carolina. And that's where I was up until I finished undergrad, and which was at South Carolina State. Actually, no, undergrad and then grad. I got my undergrad at South Carolina State, and then my master's at University of South Carolina. And I started as a biology teacher. So I got my first degree in biology education, and I did that for a couple of years. I left that. Wasn't any war stories, you know, kids weren't throwing spitballs at me or anything. I just decided that it wasn't for me. And then that's when I went into sociology. So I was in South Carolina for most of my life, and then I moved to New York to complete my PhD at the Graduate Center, CUNY Graduate Center.
So you, I didn't know this about you. So you were actually, were you training to be a teacher, or did you actually go out and spend a couple of years teaching?
Oh, I did the whole song and dance. I got a degree in biology education, and I got the certificate, and I taught for 2 years, and I thought that was going to be my life, but I think it was more of a kind of a working class thing where, so now that I'm older, I can do this kind of sociological analysis. So working class people tend to look for work, you know, when they go to school. So I just had in my mind that, okay, if I get a degree in teaching, then I can work. You know, I wasn't thinking about the meaning of, you know, or my purpose and all that kind of stuff. So that's why I went into teaching, and then I left. So yeah, I was a full-time teacher.
I know. You mentioned working, there being a class element to this. I know I grew up working class as well, and I had the same feeling. So like when I think back, you know, why did I join the army? Why did I become a police officer? I was raised and taught that to seek out these types of employment, the things that were like accessible, that I thought were realistic, that I thought like if someone had told me when I was 17, 18 years old, oh, maybe go get a PhD and become a university professor, I would have been, it would have seemed very alien. And then when I see, so my kids, so like my wife and I were both in working classes. She worked in a poster shop and I was in the army, and you know, and then she went and got a PhD in her at almost 40. And then being introduced to this new cohort of people, mm-hmm. and then realizing like they're not any different than I am. They're just regular folks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For me, it was this being introduced to this new group of people through her. Was there some event that made you, or people that you met, or some experience where you said, oh, I can go do that? Was there something that led you there?
I don't know. I think I just always liked knowledge and playing around with ideas more than the nuts and bolts of teaching. So even as a professor, we teach, but I do get the opportunity to do my own research and create my own ideas, my own knowledge. And so I think, although at the time I couldn't articulate it that way, I just knew that there was more out there for me to do. And I think that's what happened. Interestingly, I knew nothing about sociology. I can remember so clearly. I would go to bookstores. They had them, a lot of them at that time. And so I would go to, I think it was called Books a Million, and just kind of browse the books and sit and read after work. And so I read this book called Sociobiology, I think by E.O. Wilson. And so he's a some kind of, he's a biologist. I forgot what the specialization is, but he was trying to say that, okay, we can understand sociology through biological means. I didn't realize at the time that no one actually does that in sociology. But I thought, ah, okay, so maybe I want to do this. And so I said, all right, fine, I'll go into a sociology department. That sounds more interesting than biology. And that's kind of how it happened. So it was naivete that kind of pushed me along in life, it seems.
Well, some of the best things that happen to us, is, I guess, because we don't have any clue what we're getting ourselves into.
Right.
What, can you tell us sort of broadly, if and just in a few sentences, if you could tell us what it is that you study, so like what your field of expertise is?
So I identify as a digital sociologist, and my current research is dealing with cybercrime mainly, specifically internet facilitated sex work and sex trafficking.
Okay, and was there, so I understand you, the sociological imagination that you had, and you're reading these books and you think, wow, this is fascinating. This is something I'm really, really drawn into. Can you tell us a little bit about how that focus got refined as you moved along in your educational career? Was there some mentorship, some project you worked on, or some event or something that really narrowed your focus to that?
Yeah, it was a kind of a long and winding road, I guess. So at CUNY, there's a big focus on class-related issues. It's a standard social department, but it has a strong critical component and class component in race and immigration. And so my dissertation was on class consumption, and I looked at technology consumption and music consumption. So as time went on, I left the music behind, and I realized that the future of social science may include technology.
May?
It does include technology, right? And so it went that way, and I'm still a sociologist, but here at Old Dominion University, our sociology and CRIM departments are combined, and CRIM dominates. So I found myself moving into cyber crime more than just the social patterns online broadly. So that's how that happened.
Okay. So it was kind of like your interests intersected with the realities of like the workplace and those imperatives, and you found a space where, hey, this is something I'm really fascinated with, and it sort of makes sense in my career. How long have you been at Old Dominion?
This is my sixth year. So, excuse me. So I just achieved tenure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And typically most of the people I've had on here, it's been because I was doing research and it was something police related. And I thought, oh, this fits in, and I'd really like to have a conversation with this person. I'd like to focus a little bit more on this activity that you're engaged in, this like public pedagogy where you're reaching like this. I found you online and saw that you were doing something that I was interested in doing, but I thought he's doing it better than I am, where you take these complex sociological sort of concepts and explain them to the general public in a way that's consumable but not condescending, is the way I'd like to describe it.
I
really appreciate it, because as I'm listening to him, like he's explaining something very complex, and he's not dumbing it down to me, but he's also talking to me in a way like that, just that normal people have a conscience. So I really appreciated the way you were conveying the information. What was it that, because it's not something that I see a lot of academics doing, what was it that made you enter this online space as an academic? What drew you there?
Well, I think first I was a consumer of that stuff. So I love listening to people talk about ideas in any outlet. It could be a YouTube channel like yours. It could be C-SPAN. It doesn't matter. In fact, I saw you probably before you saw me. I saw your last interview. And so I just like it. I enjoy those kind of conversations. It's also the case that I'm not your standard academic, in that I don't go to a lot of conferences. My political views tend to be, I kind of bob and weave between progressive and conservative. And so it just means that I'm kind of an outlier. So one way to deal with that is to just create your own path. And so that's kind of what happened. It's also the case that in listening to these people, I realize that they're talking about a lot of social issues, but they are ignoring what comes from the ranking file in social science. So they'll pick up on a sexy idea. I think we're going to talk about white privilege a little bit today, which is fine. I mean, they'll pull that out, but they won't deal with sociological issues or social issues using sociological ideas, which is kind of weird. I mean, we're dealing with this COVID-19 thing, and the first thing that people will do is they'll bring on an epidemiologist or a doctor, and then they'll go to their opinions about it, which is fine. I mean, everyone has their opinion. But they don't do that with social science. They just start with, well, I think this, and they just move on, you know. But so there's a need for this as well.
Yeah, it's amazing how, like, when I started creating my content, it was during the COVID crisis, and I thought, here's an opportunity I can share, you know, get on, enter the space and share some information and sort of work it out, figure out, you know, what I'm doing and learn how to engage, because it's something new. And I'm sure in a year or two, I'll look back and be like, oh my goodness, what was I doing? But I've been shocked at how I started doing this right before these uprisings, riots, or whatever you people want to call them. And I've been shocked at how people are immediately experts on topics like police use of force and police policy and all of these things. Have you found, like, how have you been received? Like when you put something out into the world and you're trying to do it in a different way, where you're trying to root it in this research, how is it being received by the general population? What kind of feedback are you getting?
Well, so I really just started doing a lot more Twitter and a lot more of these hot button issues. So for the first couple of years that I had my YouTube channel, it was really for my class. So I would interview, similar to the way that you're doing it now. I was teaching a race and inequality course, and I said, well, you know, I can't talk about the Asian experience or the Hispanic experience, so let me see if I can bring someone on. Or when I started doing my cybercrime class, I did the same. You know, I don't know all about some of the tech stuff, so let me bring on some people. And so it started that way. So in that case, it wasn't a whole lot of interest. You know, people would watch it, but, you know, it wouldn't get a whole lot of views. It's only recently with the George Floyd stuff that people started to realize that I had a slightly different way of thinking about things, where I was sort of in the middle. I mean, in no way am I saying there's no systemic racism, and we'll talk about that quite a bit. But I'll also say things like, look, you know, some of this is not grounded in bad cops. It has to do with the structure of law enforcement and what they have to do. And so that kind of middle of the road approach can appeal to some people. Other people find it maybe boring, so because they want those, more polarized opinions. So in academia, I don't know. I mean, at my school, no one really does this that much. So, and I don't really bring it up too much.
And that's one of the next thing I wanted to talk about. So you have this reception, you have a particular reception with the general public, but academia is a whole, like, I'm still trying to figure out what the hell's going on half the time, because I feel like an alien most of the time, like I had landed from another planet as the, you know, 42-year-old PhD student. Everyone's 25, and there's this monolithic sort of, like, everyone sort of sees the world in very similar ways, and this uh-huh. culture, and it's like anything, you need to learn how to fit in. And I was very reticent to begin doing this and engaging the public in this kind of a way, like jumping up on YouTube and interviewing people is one thing maybe, but then taking it to the next level where you're sort of getting down into meeting people where they are. So people go on YouTube and they watch videos about topics they're interested in, and then they ask questions, and they're on Twitter, and it's sort of, but I felt as though it would be interpreted as sort of this lowbrow non-academic activity. Have you?
Probably will.
It probably will.
I mean, for me, I did it, but I didn't really talk about it a whole lot because, it's not something that many academics value, or they think that it's kind of bastardizing the discipline or something. I don't know. But I think over time, I think you're ahead of the curve, because over time, more academics will start doing this kind of stuff. So And you're starting early. I mean, you're in graduate school and you're doing it. So depending on your career track, it might actually be quite beneficial. So I started out as a person that wanted to just do research. And then I moved into public education, or at least trying to anyway. Whereas if you're someone who knows early on that what you want to do is use your knowledge to explain things to the public, then starting in graduate school is fine. I mean, it's a good start.
And so when I think back, and I don't know, maybe this is just nostalgia from a period I didn't even experience, but I just imagine in like Foucault and all of these intellectuals gathering in these halls and having, because I've read some of these things where I'm like, oh, this is not something somebody wrote. This is a transcript of a conversation. This is someone giving a speech. This is information being disseminated to the public through the spoken word. And it seems like back in the day that was something that was considered legitimate, but the public square today is YouTube and Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, yes.
So why do you think there is this, if that's the public square, what is it about this new these new platforms that you think keep academics from maybe engaging and being open on them, if that makes any sense?
I think that academics or just institutions in general want to be gatekeepers of knowledge, because we're supposed to be the authority, whether it be professors or medical doctors or what have you, right? And then someone can come along with none of our training and kind of, you know, in a way cut the line and then go on YouTube and just start talking about these issues. You don't like it, so you just kind of dismiss it. And I think that's one of the problems.
So it's about preserving power, basically.
That's a good way of putting it. Sure, certainly.
Yeah, and it's something, I mean, the ability to contain those discourses and that information and say, well, the only legitimate platform to discuss these highbrow ideas is in the classroom, in these structured environments. If you let go of that and release that, like let the genie out of the bottle, I can see how that could be very threatening. Maybe, you know, people don't even realize that they're threatened by it, but I can understand.
A part of it, yeah, is also just ignorance. Like a lot of academics don't even consume this kind of stuff. So they don't know what's going on. They don't know that these conversations are being had. But, you know, I think departments are changing. A couple of years ago, I started writing op-ed pieces for some of these digital journals. And when I first started doing this, and I told my department chair, she did, okay, whatever, you know, it wasn't a big deal. But now our university is starting to value that, we call it community engagement, maybe it's a public sociology at another place, but now people are starting to appreciate that a little bit more. And we're starting to develop some kind of metrics to understand the impact of that. The same way that you were trying to understand the impact of a peer review journal through citations. Now universities, I believe, are trying to understand, okay, well, this got so many likes, or this appeared in a small, you know, digital magazine, but then it got cited in New York Times or something like that. And they're slowly moving in that direction. So eventually.
So you could see in some future, you know, coming up for tenure and your level of outreach being something that's considered, the fact that they're engaged in these, is that something you could see it being taken to that level of seriousness where, hey, you know, you have X number of publications, but you also engaged publics in these ways? Or is it something that would be more informal, you think?
I think that when for your initial tenure and promotion, it should really be about the original research that you do, your peer-reviewed research. You're showing that you can produce new knowledge. But then after that, when you're going up from associate to full, then it's more about your impact on the discipline. So in that case, I think it's completely legitimate, and I hope that In fact, I'm sure that the equivalent to something on social media now would have been op-ed pieces and books for the nonfiction or for the layperson in like 1990. So universities do take those things into account after tenure. And so sure, you could use it just probably after tenure.
Right, so it'd be something more down the road. So you're saying it kind of aligns with that, like the op-ed, the writing the book kind of thing.
We measure your impact.
Right, yeah, because what's the point of just creating info and just siloing it and leaving it where it is? I guess the generating the knowledge is your job, but part of it is disseminating it. And I feel very fortunate actually, because we had in my department, we had a course actually dedicated to, it was called Public Criminology. Lee Slocum offered it. And it was, and she just provided us examples of, there were some theoretical readings, to understand what we were studying, but then it was just tons of examples of academics getting research and disseminating it to the mm-hmm. public. YouTube wasn't one of the things that we talked about, but, it really made me think, oh, wow, this is something that, could be valued. If she values it, then so it was a signal. I think it was an important step that's being taken. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is so the people that consume my content, I wanted them to know about your content so that they can, if they're enjoying the stuff I'm producing, I'm sure they'll really like the stuff you're producing. Can you tell us what is it that you're outside of your academic work, what is it that you're putting out to the public right now? Like what are the stuff you're creating look like?
Well, right now I'm doing videos about police brutality and systemic racism. So I do series, and since this is the hot button issue right now, this is what I'm talking about. In the past, I've done things on social isolation, which were more interviews because that's not my area of expertise. So I would kind of try and talk to people. I've also talked about Black relationships and cybercrime, and also a series on sex work, which actually was the one that got the most views. For me, a lot of views would be 400 or 500 views. So those are the ones that got the most views because people are curious. He's talking about sex, so I want to click,
Right.
So, but right now it's the, I'm talking about social issues regarding race and racial inequality and police brutality.
So how often are you putting something out, and how long might something put out be? Like how long of a video is it?
I tell you, man, if I was doing interviews, I could do something once a week because the content generates itself. You talk and then maybe you edit it. I don't know if you edit yours, but sometimes I edit mine and things kind of just meander a bit. But when I do these videos where I just sit and talk for 30 minutes or something, those are very time intensive. Because I have to kind of think about something almost like writing an essay.
Right.
Some people are good at just talking for 2 hours and they're very popular and people will just sit and listen. But I don't think I have the ability or capacity to do that. So what I do is I write something like a script, bullet points, and then I'll have it, here. And then I'll kind of talk it out. And then I'll sit and I'll edit it if I have to and post it. And so that can take some time. So those... I try to put one out once every 10 days or 2 weeks or so.
Okay. And I'll put a link below, and then you'll see one appearing on the screen right now. And what I like about what you're producing is like you could get in your car and be taking the drive to work, and you can throw in, and there's like a 20 minute long piece where you're explaining like postmodernism, but you do it, like I said, in that consumable way. So everyone check out the content. You talk about that video as being having like this right now in our culture, having this really power, like it being this really powerful powerful artifact. I don't know what word you can you just talk a Can you talk a little bit about that? Like the power, the special power, why right now you study technology? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. And actually, I think that I haven't seen the videos where you critique police shootings, but I heard in your last interview that I think you do that. So, yes. I mean, your expertise is actually valuable here. So I think in that video, I was talking about the George Floyd video as being, so the video I did about the George Floyd video was arguing that his killing showed what was the equivalent of the ideal video. So I wasn't necessarily saying that videos are important. They are. They have a special importance, but I was a special importance in society. But I was saying his video in particular
right.
has a special importance. And so this idea comes from, I forgot the criminologist's name, but he popularized the idea of the ideal victim. And it's a person who's victimized in a certain way where they're not complicit in that victimization. And so that allows the public to rally around that victim, and you can then push for certain policies. So Megan's Law, I think, what is it, the Megan's Law? The sex offender law or the child offender law, where you have to register in a sex offender database, all that stuff. Well, that person was an ideal victim, and that she was not complicit. And so that's the basic idea. And I was using it to talk about, so I'm going on a little digression a little bit, but I think it's important if you don't,
please,
if you don't
please,
mind.
No, please, let's go for it.
Okay. So I was using that in applying it to sex work, because there's been over the past 10 years, actually 20 years or so, a tremendous push to deal with sex trafficking. And sex work is illegal when it's, you know, paid consensual sex. So sex trafficking and sex work, but primarily sex trafficking. So all these laws have been passed, which have funded local and federal police departments. And there's been a push to deal with sex trafficking. Okay, that's all fine and good. No one is against that. But what they use, they being the advocates for these policies and for grant money, is the ideal victim. And so the ideal victim would be someone who's, 15, 16, white, from a good family, doing everything right in the world, not complicit in their victimization. And then someone in a white van comes up and snatches them and then sells them for sex. Okay, now that, I'm sure that has happened, right? Obviously, but that is not representative of what usually happens in sex trafficking, where it's a lot more messy, where you often have women who are using drugs, and so they get involved in a pimp. I guess they're called controllers now. A controller who says, okay, you know, I'll get you your drugs, but you need to do this for me. So it's still sex trafficking, but it's a lot messier, right? That person got into that in a different, because they were already doing something wrong. So they don't show that. They don't, you know, I'm sure you've seen those 1-800 human trafficking videos or billboards or ads where you see the young girl, maybe a bruise on her face and shackles. And so that's the ideal victim. Now that's a rational thing to do, because you're trying to generate interest in this issue and get people to say, yes, Congressman, please add, you know, more to this bill, or please, you know, I'll send money to this cause. Okay, so that's the ideal victim. I see the George Floyd video, and maybe I was wrong about this. I mean, you can tell me more. I see the George Floyd video as, compared to other videos of police brutality, as the ideal video for all kinds of reasons. One, it's a long shot. So I watched the Washington Post piece together like 12 minutes of the whole thing from start to end. And so someone like me who, you know, doesn't know policing, I can look at that and say, you know, I don't care what I know about policing, this is wrong, right? Like no matter how you talk about, well, you know, the police should have done this, the police should have done that. Me as a citizen who is ignorant of policing, I still would not be convinced that the police was justified. But in a lot of those other cases, if you look closely, the police probably did what they should have done in that scene, right? So there's always this way of equivocating, but not in this video. Also, you've got the time frame, you know, the 8 minutes and 56 seconds or 46 seconds. You've got the knee on the neck. I mean, how uncannily close is that to the Kaepernick thing? I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, all of these symbols, you've got the other police standing around while this is going on, which is symbolic of a kind of a state structure on this one black man. Black mothers are probably, once they figured out or learned that he said, you know, he was asking for his mother.
It was heartbreaking.
Like, oh God, you know. I mean, it's just all of those things came together in that video to rally people. I mean, people in other countries will see that and say, well, what the hell is going on here? Mm-hmm. You have these, a cop is killing this man and no one is doing anything but watching. You know, so it was just the perfect shot. I think in that video, I mentioned, so I'm from South Carolina, and one of the cases was, I think the name is Michael Scott. Why didn't I think about looking that up before I'm talking to you? But I think it's Michael Scott. Anyway, a guy who was running away from the police, the police shot him. Mm-hmm. And so I think initially the police got off because there is something about that Michael Scott had taken a taser from the police and dropped it and ran. And so the police then shot him or he had the taser or something. Anyway, during that first, I think the criminal case, it was like, well, you know, he was justified in doing that. And so that video, people got upset about it, but they only got like a grainy cell phone shot. They didn't see it from beginning to end. And there's all this vagaries. You don't get that with George Floyd. It's just a clear cut thing. So it's the ideal video.
Yeah, it was. When I got up in the morning and I saw like a link to it and started watching it. And I, for the last like year and a half, I've been working on a project where I had 1700 and something, 1759 police involved deaths that I went through each one and read the accounts of them. And whenever I tried to find video. And so I was immersed in these off, you know, police related deaths for an extended period of time, and nothing really, it's horrible to say, but nothing, you become very numb to it. Like, mm-hmm. like I can sit there and watch as a human being is killed by another human being, and I can code it and turn it into numbers and say, oh, this is a such and such, this is a such and such, and then move on to the next one. And 10 minutes later, it is no longer something that's, it's just kind of turned into numbers for me. It doesn't hold, you know what I mean? It's something that I'm able to slice up and categorize and move along and think about in a rational way. Mm-hmm. This particular video, for someone as like as jaded and as hardened to this topic as I think I am, it was as if you assembled a team of Hollywood producers who held a casting call and wrote a script and said, we want to create the image that
the police officer looks like a bad guy from a movie.
It is crazy. Down to the gloves and the black on the black pants, making it look almost like his hands are in his pocket. Like it's this casual, effortless, heartless, systematic destruction of human life by, and it's drawn out over this, and for me, just the first watching it, and I was like, come on, dude, what the fuck? Like, it was an emotional experience for me, so I can imagine if you're if this is not something that you see on a regular basis, I mean, the power of those images, it's astounding. I'm not at all surprised that this has turned into to what it has. When you were originally exposed to this, did you immediately know, whoa, this is going to be a major?
No. I had no idea. I mean, we've had so many of these kind of instances before. I, you know, in a kind of cynical way, I think that a lot of the protests, this is going to sound somewhat bad, maybe, but a lot of the protests were because people are like, man, I'm in the house all the time. Now I got something. I got a legitimate reason to go out, so they participated in the protests. But that doesn't take away from the value of the protests or the fact that they needed to protest. I just think that, you know, we're just in a unique time. So no, I didn't expect this at all.
I was actually when I saw the video, I thought I'm glad that we're in a quarantine right now because I think that it might take the edge off of. That there will be a certain number of people that won't go to the streets.
Ah, okay.
That's what my initial. I was off, obviously, completely wrong. But I think you really nail it. You hit the nail on the head that you like this. It just created this perfect storm of images, and it's, and I'm actually writing something about this right now. is that this this particular incident, like George Floyd, a lot of the databases that record officer involved deaths wouldn't have even recorded his death as an incident because he wasn't shot. Like the Washington Post.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and there are other databases that, that they wouldn't even classify his as an incident worth. They wouldn't record it or count it, and I just wait.
Before you go on, what's the rationale for that again? Because it wasn't a firearm involved.
Right. Yeah. So the definitions, the operational definitions that all of these like different government agencies and private organizations and news agencies are using to classify these incidents. Some of them just say, well, it's when police shoot and kill somebody.
That's right. I never thought about it. It is police shootings, but it could be other ways of killing someone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Huh. And it's not just strangling the life out of someone or shooting them, but like one of the ones that really bothers me is the when pressure is applied to individuals, say somebody is pulled over for speeding and they take off and the police chase them and they crash and die, or somebody is in a mental health crisis and suicidal and the police put pressure on that individual and they end up committing suicide. There are just so many, like I can think back to my own career and instances where now looking back, I say like one where we had a guy shoot himself. And now that I look back, I say, given the severity of the crime, was the pressure that we were applying necessary? So I just think that we need to really broaden our perspective on what is and is not a police-related death. And I think it's remarkable that this could have not been included by a lot of people in there.
That's really interesting, man. So that's something that that people need to know. Because to me, they're just two narratives, you know. Well, maybe now because of George Floyd that people are recognizing that we need to do something. But traditionally, it's been police brutality or police justified.
Right.
And they're always focusing on the shootings. But if you add in that other factor that there's this, police are putting pressure on people, which could also lead to death, that kind of throws in a little bit of a curveball. In some ways, it might actually lend to the defunding police argument in some ways. I don't know yet. I have to think. I mean, I'm just thinking about this, but that is really interesting. I mean, people need to do something, maybe do a video about these other types of shooting or deaths or something.
Yeah, and the other thing too is I think that we have this idea that this is some new phenomena, like oh, the police are all of a sudden they're going out and killing people and this is like this new problem. But I think this is the video is just shedding light on something, because if you look at like we don't have great numbers on police use of force or people killed by the police. But if you get an agency like NYPD and you look at the number of people that were killed by the police in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, up through today, you see a real dramatic improvements in how police do business. And
improvements as in?
A lot less dead people, shooting, stricter policy, better training, more professionalism. So you see over an extended period of time, I feel as though you can make a very strong argument that police have been improving, but public perceptions of the violence don't line up with that. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact, like, so someone like George Floyd, 15 years ago, that would have been a police report saying, okay, this guy fought with the police, or not George Floyd. Let me, So George Floyd, this is how I think this would have gone out is you would have had a dead man. You would have had police saying that he was fighting with the police and that he died in custody. And they would have done an autopsy and said, oh, well, he had these underlying health conditions. And this is, there's a term for, I'm totally blanking right now. Excited delirium is the term that they use, that the police will use. They'll say, well, this person, a combination of medical issues and restraints and a struggle and the hell, all led to his death. And it's this amorphous thing. And there may have been some citizens who filed a complaint and said, I watched this police officer murder this man on the street corner. And his partners would have said, no, these guys are overreacting. The guy was fighting, and it would have been filed in a cabinet, and that would have been the end of it. And no one would have heard about it. But in this environment, and you as somebody who studies technology, this crazy system of this network that exists, we're able to just share this. So someone in India wake up in the morning and saw something that happened an hour ago in Minneapolis and be outraged by it. And no other time in history has this been the case. What can you talk a little bit about, as somebody who studies technology, is this something that we can manage? Is this something that the state can manage? Having the dirty little secrets of the state be revealed to people in this way, is this something that we can survive as a society?
Well, I guess it would depend. Well, the short answer, yes, the state can manage it. China does this now through managing, through having certain choke points. So although the internet is distributed, the way that you can control that is by having certain choke points, so they can read data as it travels through. And if it's something that they don't want to get out, then they'll just block that content. So it is possible. They also make it so that I believe everyone has to license their phone, and so they can. So there's a kind of a panopticon type quality to things. So people won't record that stuff because they know that they can be traced to it, so they won't do that. So it is possible, but the question would be, do we want to do that? I mean, it is true that public opinion can run rampant, and it may not necessarily fit with the empirical realities on the ground, but would you rather people, you know, kind of have this mob-like behavior, and then we have some discussions about it, and then go that way? Or do you want to suppress free speech, which is the alternative, and stop that? So I would just rather, you know, people kind of go in a frenzy for a little while, but then, you know, reasonable people can talk it out. And then, you know, it's messy democracy, but it's probably a little bit better than the alternative.
Yeah. And I think we see the sort of, I see this emerging, where there are these calls on these corporations like Facebook and YouTube, and to restrict, to control the dissemination of information, and to like almost act like a government in how information is being and what is being disseminated. Do you have any thoughts on that? And have you experienced any of that with your content? Have you produced, you're talking about creating content on sex workers, things like that. Have you had to shape your content to get past the algorithms, or to have things taken down? Any problems like that?
No, not really. Maybe I anticipate certain things. So you want to, if I'm talking with sex workers, then I kind of let them know that you can kind of say what you want, but don't make it too graphic. And they kind of know that. And they're better at talking about sex than I am. So they already know how to navigate those conversations. So it goes well. But my personal opinion is that, well, two opinions. First, YouTube and Facebook, those are private companies, and they're not benevolent. I think we used to think that they're our friends, but they're not. They're trying to make some money, you know. So if they want to censor certain content, they can. I would prefer it if we had a more open environment for conversations. I wish that, okay, so on Twitter, they're going to censor certain things. You can't say certain things. Okay, well, that's a private platform. It would be nice if there were other competing platforms out there so that I could go there and then I can say what I want. Now, there is danger in that. There really is. There is certainly a link between what people say, if they're using stereotypes, or they're painting groups in the wrong way, or negative way, I should say. There's a link between that and then developing these stories about them, which can then lead to policy or action. So words can eventually hurt in the long run. So there's a danger in that, but I just put faith in people, which is kind of maybe stupid, but put faith in people that they can handle a few bad words now and then. Interestingly, I'm concerned about men's rights, which sounds kind of crazy, and kind of let me explain where I'm going with this. There's been a lot of talk about how boys are not doing as well as women in school. They're also, of course, historically, they go to prison more, they're committing more crimes, but also the suicide rates are high. So as a male, you know, I am interested in dealing with these men's experiences. So I think it was last summer, I don't know, somehow I found this collection, this manosphere, like this place where these men are talking about men's issues. And sometimes it can go off the rails, you know, they can be kind of misogynistic. But in general, they're talking about the issues that men face, like maybe unfair divorce, paternity suits, and all this kind of stuff. So I found that interesting. Okay, well, on YouTube, they're censored. Mm-hmm. And so I don't like it. I think it's incorrect. I don't personally like it, but I do understand it because YouTube is a brand and they want to make it so that more people will come to YouTube, and men's rights, at least the way that they talk about men's rights, can piss some people off.
And people don't want to advertise on that content. So they try to, but what is there a point? So I've been saying like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, this is the new public square, like back in the day, you know, you go to Harvard Square and put your soapbox and stand up and hand out your pamphlets and yell and scream about whatever topic you're interested in. Nowadays, if I am an activist, if I'm somebody who wants to reach the public, I go on these platforms, it's the new public square. Is there a point where this idea that it's a private institution, profit-making entity that has the right to censor as they see fit because they're a private business, which legally, I guess they can put on whatever they want. Can you foresee a point? There's an incredible amount of consolidation. Like you just said, I wish there were other platforms.
Right. Yeah.
They've developed they're very monopolistic, and our government is structured in such a way that once you acquire power, you're able to like put up barriers to entry, and mm-hmm. we haven't attacked the monopoly, and they've consolidated these platforms where you have just a handful of people on boards of directors within these companies that sort of have a lot of say. And like, let me give you an example of some content I created. Was I interviewed a friend of mine who just got her PhD, and she's going to West Point. She's going to be an instructor at West Point. And she is a counterterrorism expert. And she did her dissertation on women living in the United States who are members of ISIS. So she sort of, yeah, she did like this. It was really interesting. So she interviewed, you know, she didn't interview. She did, she read court documents. She and did all this analysis and created this like taxonomy of the different types of people, the way that these women are engaging with this organization. Legitimate academic important work by an officer in the American Army who is at West Point, but my content, I can't get it on platforms. It keeps getting booted off, and I try to engage.
Really?
So I try to engage with YouTube, and there's no human being to talk to. It's an algorithm that's being created to maximize profit. And in the meantime, I feel is important information that should be disseminated to the public. And this is the public square. And it's not, is there a point where we say, this is a utility? Is that something you can foresee, or is that something you're just completely opposed to?
I guess theoretically, or I should say practically, it is a utility. I think there's some precedent because AT&T used to have a monopoly, and they broke that up into different telephone companies because they just controlled everything. But that's a little different. I don't know. I really don't know if I would even think of it in terms of, so it is a monopoly, but it's more because of network effects. So the barriers to entry are because of us. So if someone starts a new social media network, which they can, the problem is that no one's on there. So the problem, so it's hard to pull people from a network that they're already embedded in into a new network. So it's very hard for things to start up. Who knows? Maybe in the future, the government may step in, but I don't foresee that happening. I think what might happen though, is if the costs to, this is kind of a rational choice or an economic argument, if the costs of publishing on Twitter are so high, or YouTube are so high, then people will find alternatives, or an alternative will be created, which will siphon some of those people off. But right now, it's the restrictions are not so overbearing that people feel, oh, I have to go. So like those men's rights, some of those men's rights activists, they have moved to BitChute, I believe it's called.
What's it called? I'm sorry?
BitChute.
BitChute? Okay.
Yeah. It's an alternative that's all, it's all, you know, they don't censor anything. And so some of them move over there, but it's those few who've had so much content taken off until it's like, okay, fine, you know, there's no benefit for me going on YouTube anymore. So, and they're certainly not monetized. So they're just, you know, so they just go to the BitChute and then try and get funding through Patreon or something like that. So, but that has to be overbearing. And I think that these companies are smart enough to not take it too far. Right.
Yeah. They know that maintaining that, like that our attention is the new commodity.
Yeah.
That's another thing that seems to be happening is that these institutions, these corporations are developing, and it's all about keeping our attention. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've have teams of social scientists that understand very well that the best way to do that is with this, you're creating a very specific sort of this divisive content, and you're activating, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, certain parts of the brain, you know, getting people outraged, shocked, those types of things, draw attention. Is this, is this something new, or is this something that was just done in tabloids and now it's in digital form, or is this these massive powerful institutions who are constantly in our heads? I mean, people are online all the time, and they're constantly pulling us into these two groups. Like, you know, you're either a Trumper or you're you know, Antifa now. Like, there's like
do you,
as somebody who studies these topics, technology, do you feel as though this is a new sociological phenomena, or is this something that's just a little bit more intense, something that's already existed? What do you think?
I think it's new. I think we're more polarized than we've ever been in modern times, and it is because of our it's the technology, and it's also the case that people can create their own content and then pull, you know, and there's like a sort of crab in a barrel of, no, that's the opposite. It's sort of like people are building on top of things. So you know, I produce something and it's like, oh well, I need to be more controversial or more provocative than that other guy to get the attention. So therefore I need to say something even more extreme, and so it pulls, you know. So I think it is a new phenomenon in its intensity. I mean, people have always thought differently. There was a little bit of a consensus in the past because of gatekeepers.
Right.
Certainly. I can remember, and I guess you can too, that you'd have the three stations and mm-hmm. you had Dan Rather getting up and telling you what we need to know. And even if you are a Republican or a conservative or a liberal, still you have that common ground to start from. Now, the media landscape is so fragmented that, forget it. So I was in South Carolina and my mom is watching CNN all the time. Okay, if you watch that, you get a certain understanding of Trump. He has done nothing right. Like, everything he's done is wrong. Okay, he's done a lot wrong, but he's done some things that I think many people, even within the Black community, would find okay, but it doesn't get any play because right. CNN is catering to a certain audience. Okay, well, I got a radio behind me, so this is my work room here. And I turn on, it's always on conservative talk radio or Christian radio. I'm a cultural Christian. I don't go to church, but I like listening to Christian radio. So anyway, it's conservative. Okay, Trump does everything right. Like if only I had this to listen to, I would think that Trump is this awesome president who's stopping the Chinese from taking our jobs, and he's the law and order guy, and he's making America wonderful and great again. So, I mean, that's somewhat unusual. So even in the 20s and 30s and 40s, in the era of newspapers before television, there were a lot of newspapers, and they always were, you know, some were conservative and some were liberal, some were communist. I mean, you had a lot of different newspapers, but there was always that mass media thing going on, where there's the radio there and then the TV there, and that was sort of controlled. And then you so I did this video about postmodernism, where all of these things that we used to go to that were authority figures and would dole out what we should know, we don't go to them anymore. So there's no local priest. The teachers that we listen to, they're not the authority figures that they used to be. Professors, forget about it, you know. Even when it comes to medical professionals, you can go on WebMD and figure out something. Or you've got people who are no longer in the medical profession, but they're writers, and they say, oh, you know what, I was a doctor for 15 years, and they did it all wrong. Let me tell you what they were doing, you know. And so, you know, that person speaking to your personal views about things, so you like that person. And so, yeah, this is qualitatively different, and I don't know how to deal with it. And so you've got that fragmentation, and then on top of that, you've got these algorithms that continue pushing you down this path, right? So you can't, unless you're very conscious about it, you don't realize that Google is showing you what you watched yesterday, right? Or what you searched for politically yesterday, even Yahoo. So my homepage is Yahoo, and I get the sense that they're showing me what I'm supposed to see. So I like the Dodgers, so I'm always seeing Dodgers stuff. You know? So it's just you know, this is just very different, very different.
It is, I've said it before, like it's like. It's like the printing press, you know, like the printing press changed the way information could be disseminated. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, like that's you're fundamentally changing. If you fundamentally change the way information is disseminated in a society, you should expect major changes. And I don't think we're going to know what that looks like, but we, as the nation state, like the idea of like a country, the country, we've had the idea of a country, but like the nation state, it's a relatively new concept, and it's a product of, you know, we had technological change, and we needed to design, and we needed to not create, but a new way of organizing societies came into the world. And central to that was a great book called Imagined Communities.
Benedict Anderson,
yes, and talks about how, like, I'm here in central Missouri right now, and you're out on the east. Are you in Virginia right now, or are you back? Yeah, and I didn't know if you'd gone to South Carolina with the COVID and all that. So you're in Virginia, and you have this like, you had a different childhood than I did, and different experiences. You grew up in a different place, and we have this different concepts and different ideas of what the world is, but we share this imagined idea that we're part of this community, and it's rooted in like the idea that Dan Rather can come on and tell us all the same thing, and then we have that shared understanding of the world. When you sort of rip that up, you allow everyone, you create us, now we have this new technology that drives us into these silos. And like you said, your news feed is being customized by an algorithm to draw your attention and keep it, and that's reinforcing the shit that you looked at yesterday.
And
you talk about this in your video on postmodernism, that you think that we need to sort of, and if I screw this up, I apologize, but we need to like have some shared overarching, what is that? So two parts to this question is, what do you think that looks like in the 21st century, and how do we get to the point where people buy into that? Easy question for you.
I know, right? So I guess a little background. So Francis Fukuyama, the guy that wrote that famous book, The End of History.
Yeah.
So he wrote one, which I never read, but everyone knows about it. So he wrote a book recently called Identity, which I did listen to. I'm more of an audiobook person now than a reader. And so he was arguing that in a society like ours, where we don't share a common ancestry, and even common histories, right? Like we can't, so the UK may not share a common ancestry, but they may say, look, you know, we're all from this isle, you know, I can go back, you know, 20 generations or something. Whereas a Koreans. My wife is Korean, and she'll tell me that, oh, we all descended from five people or something. Something she tells me, you know, because they can trace their history back. So we don't share that. So we need something else. And so he argues for a creedal identity, like the thing that can bring us together is a shared belief in the American creed of, you know, liberty, free speech, you know, these types of things. You got to select them, I guess, and that's the hard part, you know, because there'll be arguments about what it is to be American, but maybe individualism, belief in economic progress, whatever. But he's arguing that we need that, otherwise we're gonna break apart. So what that is difficult because people will argue about that. So we need it's kind of ironic, like we need overarching values of some kind, but people to bring people together. But the people that are apart will argue about what it is that we need to bring us together, right? That will be the difficult part of it. But how we do it, I don't know. I think there's some precedents. I mean, there were times in the past that I've read about and immigration scholars talk about where there was an era of assimilation in the United States where mm-hmm. people were asked, okay, you're coming to this country and so you need to adopt what it is to be an American and whatever those things were. I don't know. And so people would do it because at that time we didn't have these values of multiculturalism to deal with. And so people, the authorities and the immigrants coming in didn't feel that they had to keep so much their Italian heritage or stuff. They certainly, actually no, the Italians and especially the Italians and then some of the Irish, they tended to keep their identities a bit longer than Scandinavians or Germans, you know. So, or even Scottish people actually. So we had something in the past where we could sort of inculcate these values, but that's gone now. We celebrate diversity, we celebrate multiculturalism. So I don't know. You have kids, do they do the Pledge of Allegiance, and do they talk about what it is to be American in their primary school still? Or?
Yeah, so there was some indoctrination. So Pledge of Allegiance and some sort of, I call it propaganda. I think it's good. I think it's important.
Some people don't like that actually. I mean, it all depends on your particular stance. There may be other ways of people.
But I think like what you're saying, like having some sort of shared understanding of who we are as a people, if we want to mean peace and security. I mean, I think it's important. And schools, I mean, seem like, and I know that originally that was a place where children, especially, were and one of the fundamental reasons we have schools is to create the shared enculturating experience, so that we're all on the same page as we enter the workspace. Mm-hmm. I've had some experience in both Canada and the United States. So my mother was Canadian, my father was American, and after the war of Vietnam, they went back to Canada. So I was in school in Canada and in the US. And it was a much more intense propaganda in Canada, where I think it has to do with being next to the world's, to a superpower, where maintaining a Canadian identity is very difficult because you're bombarded with American culture, media, newspapers. So they put up these barriers to entry to American media. So a certain percentage of the music needs to be Canadian, a certain percentage of the television needs to be Canadian, and it's to preserve this Canadian identity. And then in the schools, there's this very concerted effort to like indoctrinate the children into these shared set of ideas. So like a lot more of like it's not the pledges, it's more like courses, like classes focused on what it means to be Canadian, what it means to be a good Canadian. And then on the television, you'll have like commercials funded by the federal government that are like, you know, what's the origins of the word Canada, what's it means to be a Canada, a little, yeah, like little, a little 30-second clip of some historical thing, and, you know, and it's trying to create this shared sense of community, and it's a government project. It's like a concerted effort. And I don't see that in the United States to the degree I do.
No. And we can't even agree on our origins. I mean, history shouldn't be something our interpretations change, but history by definition doesn't change, right? But we're now changing the way we think about our country's founding with this 1619 project, which is very, very big in this area because this is where the first Black Americans came, was in, I want to say Jamestown, but I can't remember. But anyway, it was around this area. So the 1619 project is in some ways re-envisioning our founding as being about slavery. And so a lot of people are saying, no, that's not accurate. The founders didn't care about slavery. That just came later. And our founding was about something entirely different. It was about religious freedom. And so we can't even agree on that. I mean, it's just really the one way of thinking about the tearing down of the statues, the Confederate statues, is a change in what it means to be American. So I think a lot of white Americans would see this as just a part of their history, those Confederate statues, integrated, interwoven into American history. It's not a pretty history in some cases, but they will certainly say, well, still, that those are my forefathers, right? Well, we're changing that. I don't think that's a bad thing, actually. But I'm just illustrating the point that we can't even agree on some of these things, right? It's really, it's troubling to see, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just being hyperbolic. I mean, it doesn't look like the country. So even though there's these protests, some people would argue that, look, these protests are wonderful because they're multiracial protests. It's not like Ferguson, where you kind of saw it was mainly Black people out there rioting and protesting. Now, I shouldn't say rioting, that's kind of bad, actually, because most of them were protesting, right? It was just some rioting. Now you're seeing it is far more of a consensus across racial groups that, look, something's going on and we need to do something about it. So it might be that, you know, my fear that the country is breaking apart because we don't share values, it might be unfounded. It might be fine in 10 years, who knows?
I wish I were optimistic. I find this like a terrifying sort of period in our history. I really am worried about how this unfolds. Not to be super pessimistic. One thing, and I've taken up a ton of your time. I just wanted to move on to just one final topic, and it was. I have a cross section of people that have been sort of following my content, and a lot of them are like officers and people more conservative folks, and then on the other side I have, you know, people who are way off to the left. And one of the things I liked about your when you talk about you explain what white privilege is. Mm-hmm. I like that when you explain it, I was like, I'm not sure what his political
that's usually how it works.
right And that's one of the things I like about the way you lay things out, is I can imagine, because I spend half my time with my conservative friends and half because with my more liberal friends, and they view the world in completely different ways. But mm-hmm. when I hear you explain these topics, who normally I'm like, my conservative friends are just going to call BS immediately on this, and my liberal friends are going to say he's not going far enough. When I hear you explain it, I'm like, they're both going to be confused because they're going to sort of understand what you're saying and sort of follow, and they're not going to know what you're. So if you could just for a couple minutes, just give us a taste of how you would explain a topic like that, so that people have an idea of when they turn to you for insights on these complex ideas, what they might expect in terms of explanation.
So white privilege, as it's understood in the university, is unearned privileges. for being white. And so my own take on this is that, okay, if you look statistically, that is accurate, actually. But it's not necessarily because of anything that an individual white person is doing. It's just how society is kind of structured. So, you know, I think in that video, I kind of explained, okay, there's this woke crowd that is trying to make everything about, no, that's a different video. I'm sorry. No, that's different. I don't think I've mentioned the woke crowd in that video, but I can't remember. But some of the issues with white privilege for me is that they point out these symbolic things that aren't that, to me, that relevant. So one of the famous examples from the white privilege literature, this is the main article that started all this, was from Peggy McIntosh. She wrote that article or essay, The Invisible Knapsack. And so she points out things like the Band-Aids are not the color of a Black person's skin. They fit more the color of a white person's skin. And that's a privilege, as she would argue. Or your hair care products are in the ethnic section for a Black person, whereas yours are just in the hair section, right? And so a lot of that is accurate in the sense that that is how things are, but I don't necessarily think that they matter for most Black people. They don't care. That matters when you go to college and someone teaches you that it cares, that you should care about it. Otherwise, you just go about your life. So to me, those are superficial things. They're worth talking about, you know, around the dinner table, but they're not connected to social outcomes. So for me, I'm more concerned about things like jobs and where people live, income and wealth. And so when you look at it that way, then yes, there is you can see statistically that all things being equal, it seems as if whiteness matters. And so the way that I prefer to think about white privilege is not necessarily that a white person is gaining something. I tend to think of it as your race not mattering. So if you say you've got a privilege, then a person can easily say, well, you know, I grew up in Oklahoma and my mother had to raise me alone because my father was an alcoholic, and what kind of privilege do I have, right? That person would be absolutely right. You know, regardless of their race, you know, they had to put in the work to get out of that hole that they were in. So telling a white person that they have privilege in that way, it just makes no sense for their everyday life at all. So they would deny that they have privilege. They could also deny that the privilege, so even if they had privilege, that they can also say something like, I don't care if I was white, I still had to work, you know, 12 hours a day for 10 years to build my business. So thank you for the Band-Aids, but I still had to put in all that work, right? I mean, and again, they would be right. So saying that, you know, a person is given something for their race, I don't think is that effective. It might be accurate in some abstract sense, but it's not effective. So I prefer to think of white privilege as the privilege of not having your race work against you, which is also, it's just the opposite, but it still conforms to the empirical realities. Mm-hmm. So even with that example of the alcoholic mother or father and being raised by a single mom, if you equalize over 1,000 white cases of that and 1,000 Black cases of that, you will still find that the Black person has, on average, worse outcomes, even when you equalize for that terrible experience. So there is something there that needs to be studied. I think I ended that video by saying, you know, these kind of virtue signaling things where a person says that they check their privilege at the door, and all of that's a class-based thing. I think it's nice for white middle-class people or academics to make that comment. It makes them feel good, but it doesn't have anything to do with those rallies on the ground. Dealing with white privilege has to be about policy. But just individuals, whatever, enjoy your privilege is what I tell people.
So you'd frame it and say, like, the person who had the rough childhood and all the obstacles, the white guy from wherever, and he's able to start the business and move forward, you would say, well, it's not that you were privileged and given some advantage because of your whiteness. It was that in addition to all of those obstacles that you had to fight to overcome, you didn't have this additional obstacle that you would have had if you had a different identity. And I think that that's much more like consumable and palatable, it makes much more sense to somebody who's in that position. Cause I don't think anybody wants to be told that they have an advantage, but if you say, well, that there's one extra thing that you don't have to worry about. And it also conforms to the reality, like of what the numbers tell us. I think that's a much more, because the goal is to convince people that we have a social problem so that we can address it and create a more equitable society, right? So if you frame it in a way where you just alienate people and piss them off and they don't want to work with you, then it's kind of counterproductive, I guess.
That's true. And I think a lot of this, there's some class dynamics that are at play here. So I would imagine if I was at Stanford or Penn and I was teaching a bunch of wealthy students, not all of them are wealthy and not all of them are privileged, I know.
But most of them are, though.
Yeah, quite a bit of them. So let's say I was talking about white privilege there. They might be more comfortable saying, oh, yeah, I have privilege. Like they'll be more likely to accept that definition. And really, most of our understandings come from those institutions and they trickle down. So, you know, saying that you have unearned benefits is fine for that group. And so that's kind of the knowledge that comes down to us. But if I'm talking to my students at Old Dominion University, those students are not privileged, you know. Right. And so telling them that they have an advantage, the white students, telling them that they have an advantage just makes no sense. So it's better to, yes, just say, you know, you don't have to worry about race bothering you, certainly.
And I think, like you say, class, like my, as like moving, like swimming through these different classes in American society, I've noticed that my friends who are from working class backgrounds, so my friends that are academics and whose parents were doctors and lawyers and professors, and they seem to spend a lot of time thinking about like self-actualization and who I am as an, you know, and all these types of concepts, whereas like my working class friends, it's more about, can I maintain the discipline that's required and develop the skills that are necessary to keep a job, to this very practical sort of way of thinking.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you know what, I wish that there were more, so sociology and criminology for PhDs anyway, are not gonna pull a lot of working class students, because they're like, look, I'm gonna spend 8 years, 19 years of my life for this, you know, for this salary at the end. No, I'm gonna go in engineering or something. But we need more working class students, because they will ask those questions that are more on the ground realities. I mean, I can remember, so okay, I just talked about the Confederate statues some while ago, and I said that they're a few minutes ago, and I said that I'm glad that they're coming down. I think that they send the wrong message. That is true. At the same time, I imagine that I and my parents and the people in my neighborhood where I grew up would care nothing about those statues if they were working in the building next door. They'd probably go get a ham sandwich and sit on the statue and eat it. Like, they wouldn't care anything about that statue. It does have some symbolic resonance, but nothing like a job, you know, nothing like, you know, taking care of your family. And so sociologists would do well, I think, and be more relevant if they would ask some more of those materialistic questions about how to get on in life.
Yeah, part of a PhD maybe should be required working at a Walmart for a year. I think the questions would definitely change, and I think you'd have a lot more people drop out if that were the case. Like, I've taken up a ton of your time. I just wanted to give one more opportunity just to to just throw the ball into your court, and any sort of parting thoughts, or with all that's going on, what's on your mind. Just the floor is yours.
Well, first, thanks for doing this, man. I mean, you're putting together something that I think is going to really grow. It's really interesting what you're doing, and you ask really good questions, and the conversation flows well. So just some kudos to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I remember when I did my first three interviews, it was hard for me to even finish a sentence. I was like, well, okay, what do you think? You know, so you're pretty good at this. You seem to be a natural. But I think I guess I could end by saying, you know, I'm proud of these protests, the peaceful protests. And I think that there's something really important here that is being said by those protesters. And I hope that people listen across the aisles. When I turn on my conservative radio here, they're talking about the riots and they're talking about how police are justified. You know, they're right about some of that, but there's a bigger issue here of human life and human welfare. And, you know, maybe we should focus on that. Then we can get back into our political corners and duke it out.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I hope everyone enjoyed this, and I'm going to put links below to link to your content. It's fantastic. He does a great job of explaining some really complex ideas in a very understandable way. So thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I hope that we actually get to meet in person at some point.
We will at some point.
All right. Thank you. Have a great one.
All right. Take care, man.